start the afternoon session. I'm pleased to introduce the first speaker of the afternoon, John Harden.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation, and it's an honor to be here at the 50th Cornell Topology Festival. I'm going to be talking about groups acting on manifolds. So the story begins with Hilbert's fifth problem, but if I start out with Hilbert's fifth problem, it sounds fairly abstract at the beginning. So I want to just start off with a few motivating questions and give a concrete example. So the question basically is, well, what groups can act on the manifold? So by this, I just mean we have some topological group, and it's equipped with a homomorphism to the group of homeomorphisms of some manifold. And, well, so we might as well replace G with its image, so we can just assume this is injective, and then add the adjective faithfully. Now, it's not clear at the moment, but it's going to become clear later that in order to answer this question, we're going to need to study some related question, which is how close can the image be to the identity? In other words, if I pick some really small neighborhood of the identity in the homeomorphism group, is there some non-trivial compact group there acting? Okay, so let's start now with a concrete example. So this is a theorem due to Newman around 1934, and it says the following. So suppose U is an open set in Rn, and just to fix length scales, let's suppose it contains the open ball of radius 1. So then suppose that the group of integers mod p is acting on U, and every orbit has diameter no more than, say, 1 over 20. In this case, the action is trivial. So this is sort of answering a version of the second question here for a special case of a cyclic group. So I find that not many people have seen this theorem before, or at least that's been my impression. So so it's stated with a prime, but it can be any positive integer. So suppose we have some action of the group Z mod P on the open set U, and with the property that every orbit is less than has small diameter, and this constant being independent of P, then there's no action other than the trivial action. So in order to prove this, we want to consider an averaging map. So we can map U to Rn. Well, let's see. Maybe I should establish some notation for the action first. So let's say F from U to U generates Z mod P. Then we're going to consider a map from U to Rn, which is just the averaging map. So I'm going to send a point x to the average of its orbit. And this is just the average in Rn. This proof would not work in characteristic P. So this map now has two interesting properties, which are actually contradict each other. So on the one hand, just think about this map geometrically. This is an average over an orbit, and we know all the orbits are very small. So If you consider just the distance between this map and the identity map from U to U, they're very close together. And so V is close to the identity. And what this means is that the degree of V is 1. The degree meaning I just take some generic point, say 0, and count the number of inverse images under phi. So I guess it isn't. So you have to consider the that's why I need this consider this condition here. So if this is small enough, then just take say the inverse image of 0, and then as you're moving, if you take the inverse image of 0.001, it'll have the same number of inverse images as 0 because you have this big open set. But that's a good point to make here. And notice also, I didn't say anything about the action being differentiable or nice at all. It's just some continuous map from U to itself. So you can't really just pick any old point here in the image and say 0 and expect the inverse image to be discrete. So I'm leaving out some details that you have to be careful when you make this argument. And so the second property is that phi factors through the quotient by Z mod p. And this, if the action is non-trivial, then this map certainly has degree p. And so the degree of phi is congruent to 0 mod p. So again, for you to really make sense of this statement, naively you'd want the action to be differentiable Yeah, you need some assumptions, but the most naive argument of this requires some assumptions on the map, but in fact you can make it work in general. So this proves Newman's theorem. Sorry. Oh, I mean, I just took something that seemed small enough. I mean, you could probably do a little bit better than that. But I'm not sure anybody's thought about.
What you need is to make sure that orbits outside the ball of radius 1 stay outside the ball of radius 1.
That or don't go to 0. There's a way to rephrase this theorem, I'll call theorem prime, which is sort of more in the language of Hilbert's fifth problem, and that's the following. So suppose M is a manifold with a metric. And U is some open set, then there exists some epsilon greater than 0 such that the following set of homeomorphisms has no compact subgroup, compact Lie subgroup. So let's just look at all the homeomorphisms which don't move points in the set U very far. So distance from X, the phi of X is less than or equal to epsilon for all X in the open set U. So why is this equivalent? Well, if I had some compact Lie subgroup, if I had some compact Lie group sitting inside here, we have some abelian subgroup, and the abelian subgroup would have something isomorphic to Z mod P. And well, if I chose epsilon small enough, then I'd have some ball in the set U, and we'd contradict Newman's theorem above. So one way of stating the Hilbert-Smith conjecture is that I just want to extend this theorem and cross off the word Lie. No, it contains no compact subgroup. And this is, you can think this is related to question number two I have up there, which is how small a subgroup can you find in the homeomorphism group of a manifold? That's sort of what we want to be thinking about here. Namely, I suppose I'm only allowed to move, I have this a huge manifold, but I'm only allowed to move points by some positive epsilon. Can I make any subgroup? Can I make any symmetry group of the manifold in that way? OK, so now let's talk about Hilbert's fifth problem. And that's the following. So if G is a group manifold, is G a Lie group? So in other words, when we're defining Lie groups, do we really need to add the assumption that G is a smooth manifold with smooth group operations? Is it enough just to say G is a topological manifold and the group operations are continuous? So do we get any more sort of exotic families of Lie groups if we just allow continuous group operations? So the answer, I guess, well, let's see, this is around 1900. And the answer in 1950s is yes. So there aren't actually any sort of exotic group manifolds. They're all just Lie groups. And in fact, the Lie group structure is unique. So this is due to a number of people, Gleason, Montgomery, Zippin. And Yamabe. And what they proved, in fact, was a lot more than just the answer to this question. A lot of what their work dealt with was not just groups that are manifolds, but groups that are locally compact. And one of their results was the following theorem, namely, so suppose G is any locally compact group, then G is a Lie group. If and only if it has no small subgroups. So let me tell you what no small subgroups means. We say G has no small subgroups if and only if there exists some open neighborhood of the identity. Containing no subgroup. So if you think about a Lie group and the local isomorphism with the tangent space at the identity by the exponential map, it should be clear that a Lie group does indeed have no small subgroups. And the converse is a pretty hard theorem. So if you have this theorem, then to prove to give the correct answer to Hilbert's fifth problem, you have to show that a group manifold also has no small subgroups. And you could imagine that this is kind of a lot more difficult since you don't have the exponential map when things aren't differentiable. And it is a hard step in the proof of Hilbert's fifth problem. OK, so there are various interpretations of what Hilbert's fifth problem actually states. And this is sort of the it's the version that was solved, and it's sort of the most common interpretation. And there's another interpretation, which is a stronger statement that's known as the Hilbert-Smith conjecture, which is that if G is locally compact and acts faithfully on a manifold, then G is a Lie group. So this is certainly a stronger statement than this conjecture over here, because if you have a group manifold, well, it's certainly locally compact, and it acts faithfully on itself by left translation. So this implies Hilbert's fifth problem. And it's known for in dimensions 1 and 2. Or is known by the same people who proved the answer to Hilbert's fifth problem. It's sort of it's not particularly difficult in low dimensions. But sorry, the dimension of M, yeah. So you could rephrase this as G is Lie. You could rephrase this as G has no small subgroups by this theorem. And so you can see that this conjecture about what locally compact groups can act on manifolds is actually very related to this question I brought up earlier. How close to the identity can you get some group to act on a manifold? And it's also known that this Hilbert-Smith conjecture is equivalent to just treating the case where G is the p-adic integers. So it's known that it suffices to show ZP cannot act faithfully. So maybe I should define, since this is a topology conference, I'll define the p-adic integers for you. This. So we have the integers mod p to the k, so fix a prime p, and then there's a map from mod p of the k reduction from z mod p of the k plus 1 to z mod p to the k, and you take the inverse limit of this system. So this is a typical local, it's a compact group, and it's a compact group which is not a Lie group. So this theorem says it must have a bunch of small subgroups, and the small subgroups in this case are very easy to see. Namely, they're the groups p to the k times z to the p, zp. So everything congruent to 0 mod p to the k. Okay, so that's, I think, all I'm going to say about generalities, about sort of background on Hilbert's fifth problem and the Hilbert-Smith conjecture. Now I'm going to start talking about properties of three manifolds, and when I'm done with that, we'll see how we can apply it to this problem. So I'm going to be talking about some interesting properties of surfaces in three manifolds. Okay, so I want to consider the following class of manifolds. So M is a three manifold, and it's going to be connected, orientable, irreducible. Okay, the adjectives get more interesting after this. H2 of M is Z, and M has exactly two ends. So for example, M might be some surface cross R, some where the surface has genus at least one. So this is a pretty boring example from the standpoint of what I'm going to talk about. But you can get more interesting examples, say, just from forming compression bodies of surfaces and then gluing them together end to end. So we're just going to think about this manifold as sort of drawn schematically like this. We have some surfaces in here, maybe representing a generator of H2, and there are two ways of going off to infinity in the manifold. So this is M, and we can label the ends. There are two of them with, say, minus and plus. So for such a manifold, I'm going to define the set of a certain set of incompressible surfaces. So we're going to look at embedded surfaces in M such that F is incompressible and F generates the second homology group. So basically exactly what I've drawn over here, some surface like this. In the case of M equals a surface cross R, this set is pretty boring. It just has, well, once I mod that by isotopy, it has exactly one element. It's just the fiber. But in general, this set M could have some very wild ends, and this is some pretty interesting object. So you might ask, why is this even non-empty? Well, you can just take any surface which represents a generator of H2 of M, and then sort of take a just keep compressing it, and eventually you'll arrive at an incompressible surface. So this has at least one element. So we're going to define a partial order on S of M as follows. So let's say the class of F1 is less than or equal to F2 in S of M, if and only if we can realize them such that F1 is contained in, well, I'll just write M minus F2 minus. So over here on this diagram, what this looks like is the following. So I have two surfaces, F1 and F2. And well, most two surfaces aren't going to, some random pair of two surfaces is not going to be able to be realized disjointly. But if we can somehow isotope F1 and F2 so that they're disjoint, I'll just say that the one closer to the minus end is less than the one closer to the plus end. And this is just if you're just given two surfaces, it's not really clear necessarily whether this relation holds, because this set is only defined up to isotopy, so you have to determine whether you can isotope them to be disjoint. It's not clear, so yes, that's what I'm going to talk about next. So this is a partial order. Okay, so to show it's a partial order, we need to check three things: reflexivity, anti-symmetry, and transitivity. So reflexivity says a surface F is less than or equal to itself. That's pretty easy because F is embedded, so it has some tubular neighborhood, and we can just push it off in one direction. Things are orientable, so the normal bundle is trivial. To prove transitivity, that's also actually pretty easy. So what does transitivity say? Well, you have some surfaces, F1, F2, say F2 prime, and F3, and but F2 and F prime might intersect each other. So they could be different. So we know that F1 is closer to this end than F2, and F2 prime is closer to this end than F3. But we only know that these two surfaces are isotopic. They might be different. Well, that's not a big problem, though. We can just find some isotopy which sends this one to this one and look at where F1 goes under that. So then we get F1 is less than F3. Proving anti-symmetry, though, is sort of the point of this. That's not actually all that clear. So suppose we have some classes, F1 less than F2, less than F1. So we want to show that they're the same. Now, what does this mean geometrically? Well, it means we can realize F1 and F2 like this. And then by the same argument that we used to prove transitivity, we know that we can realize F1 on the right side over here. And well, from some three-manifold topology, we know that that means that the region between F1, or this copy of F1 and, say, F1 prime, is actually an I-bundle. And so if we have this incompressible surface F2 in the I-bundle, it has to be a fiber. So this means that in this set modulo isotopy, we have F1 equals F2. So that finishes the proof that this is a partially ordered set. So there's actually something even more interesting about this set, and that's that it's a lattice. So this theorem was suggested to me by Ian Agel, and that is that this is a lattice. And what that means is that for any two choices of any choice of two surfaces, say F1 and F2, the set of everything greater than both of them has a least element. So we look at all G such that G is greater than F1 and F2 has a least element. Okay, so geometrically, what does this mean? We have our manifold, looks like this, and we have our two surfaces, F1, F2, and maybe they intersect somewhere. There's no reason they should be disjoint. And we want to look at everything to the right of them and say that, well, there's some sort of unique surface that's sort of closest to the minus end, but still to the right of both F1 and F2. So this is our sort of potential candidate for H. Has the least element. Let's call it H. I'll need that for the, So this isn't going to, if we just sort of pick any representatives of F1 and F2, the strategy to produce H is not going to work. Because, you may have picked some sort of bad representatives, and so maybe F had some long finger that did that, in which case H would would be something like that. And in particular, the surface H that I drew earlier would not be to the right of this guy. So what we'd sort of like to do is, well, there are two things we could do. We could say, well, pick any representatives of F1 and F2, and then try to simplify their intersections by getting rid of things that look like this. Or we could try to pick canonical representatives of F1 and F2 and show that they sort of have good enough intersection properties that the strategy for making H does work. So it turns out that what you want to do is pick minimal area representatives of F1 and F2. So let's see, why does that work? So there's a theorem by Mike Friedman, Joel Haas, and Peter Scott, which basically says that if we have area minimizing surfaces in a three manifold, then their intersections, area minimizing incompressible surfaces in an irreducible three manifold, then they sort of have as few intersections as possible, given their isotopy classes. So I'll just state sort of the simplest version. Suppose F1 and F2 in M, so these are incompressible. And this is irreducible oriented. Are area minimizing. And can be isotoped to be disjoint. So in this case, then either they are disjoint, or there's an extra case. Maybe they're the same. So with this extra ingredient, we can finish this, or we can fix this incorrect proof of the theorem that this is a lattice. So instead of just picking any representatives of F1 and F2, we're going to pick area minimizing ones. So then we have F1, F2 here, and this dotted line will be our surface H. Now, there's a slight issue that maybe this H is not incompressible, but I will then just take any maximal compression of it and call that H. It won't matter. So let's prove that H is a least element of this set. If we had any element G of that set, G is greater than both F1 and F2. So let's pick an area minimizing representative of G. Now, by the theorem, G is disjoint from F1 and F2. And so, well, since we proved anti-symmetry, it could equal F1 or it could equal F2, but those cases are less interesting. If it's disjoint from F1 and F2, it's actually to the right of both of them. And in particular, it's to the right of H. So we get that the class of H is less than the class of G. And so H is the least element of that set. Now, as a corollary, you see that it doesn't matter what compression I take of H. You always get the same surface, because by the proof, it's the least element of that set, and it has the least elements certainly unique. And it seems reasonable that maybe whenever you do this construction and get a surface H, it's always incompressible. But I'm not sure whether that's true. Yeah, so they might, but you could always sort of push them back since G is incompressible. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit about the proof of the following theorem, which is so ZP cannot act faithfully on a three-manifold. So this is the three-dimensional case of the Hilbert-Smith conjecture. Okay, so let's so we're gonna discuss the proof. So suppose we have some action of ZP on M. Now, what we want to do is take advantage of the fact that the Hilbert-Smith So first, I'm going to give you a wrong proof, and then we'll see how to correct it. What we want to do is take advantage of the fact that the Hilbert-Smith conjecture is known in low dimensions. So what you could imagine trying to do is just pick some set, I'll call it Z0, and let Z be its orbit. So let's say open set. And we'll look at its orbit. Now, so maybe I should have said this a bit earlier, but it's a good idea to note that we can always replace ZP by P to the K ZP, because these are isomorphic. Now, if we choose K large enough, then these are form a neighborhood base of the identity in this group. So these are mapped to I can choose K large enough so that these are mapped arbitrarily close to the identity in the homeomorphism group of M. And so in particular, if I look sort of coarsely at the action, it's essentially not moving points at all. They're all sort of very easily seen to be isotopic to the identity. And if I'm just thinking geometrically, this operation of taking the orbit set basically does nothing to the set. It sort of could make it grow some wild fuzz on the boundary. But if I have some really coarse geometric property of Z0, then Z has the same property. So if we just pick some random open set, maybe a sphere, then we could take its orbit. Then ZP acts on the boundary, and well, maybe this is a two-manifold, and this contradicts the case of Hilbert-Smith in two dimensions. So now the problem with this, of course, is that, as I said, the boundary of Z could be wild. It could grow some wild fuzz, and so the boundary is certainly not a two-manifold. So instead, we have to do the following. So instead, we'll consider set U, which is sort of an epsilon neighborhood of Z minus Z. So you should think of this as sort of an approximate tubular neighborhood of the boundary of Z. So the boundary of Z isn't a two-manifold, but if you look at it on sort of a coarse geometric scale, it's almost a two-manifold. And so you might think, well, it's a neighborhood of z minus z is approximately a two-manifold across the interval. And this set U is now, I've erased a definition, but it satisfies the properties of manifolds for which we're considering this lattice of incompressible surfaces.
What are you supposing about M?
Connected. That's all.
Is it complete for its metric? Are you allowing boundaries?
So I think it's starting off without a metric at all. And it's, in fact, you can reduce to the case M as an open set in Rn fairly easily using Newman's theorem. And some people also like to restrict to M being a compact manifold, but it's not really going to be relevant. We're just going to sort of look locally at things. So in this case, then ZP acts on the set of incompressible surfaces in U. And this is where it's very important that S of U is a lattice. I didn't say this earlier, but the whole point of proving that S of U is a lattice is that if you have any group acting on a lattice with finite orbits, then it always has a fixed point, because you just take a finite orbit and look at the least upper bound of that. That has to be fixed. So it's very easy to find elements in S of U which are fixed by ZP. And so you sort of get an action of ZP on that fixed surface, which is going to serve as a sort of approximate boundary for Z. OK, so that was a very rough outline. But let's make things a lot more explicit now. So the surface, so Z is going to be the following set. So I want to take a handle body of genus 2. Let's call this, let's call this K naught. Let K equal ZP K naught. So this is all taking place inside the 3-manifold. Or really, you could just consider some small Euclidean chart on the 3-manifold. And so this picture is just really an R3. And this is just literally what you think it is. It's a solid handle body of genus 2. And I'm going to assume that the action of ZP is very close to the identity. So I have different notation for K and K naught, but the picture is really valid for both of them, because K naught, when you take its orbit, sort of grows some wild fuzz, and you don't really know what wild phenomena are happening on the boundary. But at least you know it's a closed set. So I'll take this to be a closed handle body and this to be closed. OK. So then we're going to add a few loops to the boundary. Now, say call that L0, let L equal the orbit of L0, and we'll let Z equal K union L. So I've drawn these loops very big so you can see them. But I really, if I were to draw the picture to scale, I would have drawn them so small that you couldn't see them. Because what you need is that you're going to have a bunch of loops, and it's going to create some first homology, which is permuted by ZP. So want to choose the loops so that ZP acts non-trivially on the first homology of Z. So these are wild sets. So really, I'm not thinking singular cohomology at all. It's check cohomology. Sorry? Yeah, so I meant to draw it so that you could see it, but I guess I didn't draw it big enough. So you sort of pick some boundary points on K, which are very close together, and then you draw some loop in the complement of K to connect them. A very very explicit construction. There's not really anything deep about this. Just add a loop. And you make it so small that when you take its orbit under ZP, you really get a bunch of loops very, very far away from each other. And that's what enables you to find this. Choose the loop so you have this property. And you actually have to do a lot of point set topology to make sure that this property holds, and that you can choose loops to do this. I'd like to sort of make it more transparent, but it seems like there are a lot of details that need to be explained to make this work out rigorously. But once you have this, then it's sort of straightforward. It's clear to explain how you can get a contradiction. So I'm going to consider the set before the neighborhood of Z minus Z. So for this we need to pick some metric on the manifold which is invariant under ZP, because I'm considering the epsilon neighborhood, and I want ZP to act on the set U, and it's not going to act on the set U if it's not going to fix the set U unless I took some neighborhood with respect to an invariant metric. But that's not a particularly hard thing to arrange. You just take any metric on M and average it over the Haar measure on ZP. So we get this action. And therefore it acts on the surface on the set of incompressible surfaces in U. Let's see. So it's not that hard to see why U satisfies the conditions that I said earlier. So certainly U is an open subset of R3, so it's certainly orientable. So it might not be connected, but you can just take the big connected component of it. Now there's a point I sort of glossed over here when I was talking about S of M. I mean, I didn't say whether we were working on the topological category or the smooth category. I mean, usually when you talk about incompressible surfaces, you're thinking I have a nice smoothly embedded disk that might be compressing the surface. And when you're doing isotopies, this is all usually done in PL or diff. So that's a slight issue, since this map is only an action by homeomorphisms. But if you're careful enough with the definitions of S, this lattice of incompressible surfaces, and with the proofs, that it actually does carry through and completely topologically. So you get this action, and that's perhaps one obstruction to trying to carry out this proof in higher dimensions. Namely, if you wanted some lattice of hypersurfaces, it's not clear what the best definition is to use, which is just uses topological information. Okay, so what do I get from this? We know there's a fixed point. Okay. Now, from a fixed point, so let's realize F as some actual surface in U. Now, what does it look like? So away from the loops, it's going to look essentially like the boundary of K naught. It's basically a surface of genus 2. It's a compact surface, finite type. And near the loops, well, you sort of think of it as following the loops around. We don't really know what's going on here. It could have a really large genus, but it's at least a compact surface. And we'd sort of like to have an action of ZP on this surface, because that would give us our dimension reduction. But that's not really going to happen, because if we act on our surface by an element of ZP, we get something isotopic to it, but it's not actually the same surface as a set. So all we get is a homomorphism from ZP into the mapping class group of our surface. And it satisfies two properties. So on the one hand, I want to look at the homology of the surface, which is fixed by ZP. So we don't know very much about the surface F. We know basically two things. It over in sort of away from the loops, it looks like a surface of genus 2. And near the loops, we have some action of ZP, and it's permuting the homology of F in some non-trivial way. So geometrically, what this sort of looks like is, think of it as something like this. Over here, I have the portion of F which has genus 2, and it's entirely fixed. And ZP is sort of moving. I have maybe like NP handles over here, which are being moved around by ZP. So this is just a very schematic diagram. But it sort of gives you the intuition that such an action can't exist, because we know that such a finite order element of the mapping class group has to fix a hyperbolic metric. And so you'd have sort of these simple closed curves here, which are fixed up to isotopy by the action. And so their unique geodesic representatives in the hyperbolic metric are fixed. And once you have that, the action has to be trivial, just by unique continuation of isometries. So that's sort of a motivation for the following. So I claim that I can't get actually geodesic, actual simple closed curves in F which are fixed. But I claim that this group, just the homology, I have the following sort of much weaker homological condition. So let's look at the homology, and I claim that this has a submodule where the intersection form is given by two copies of the hyperbolic pair. So how do you get that? Well, you see these two loops here. Let's call this alpha 1 and beta 1. And they're both fixed by the action of ZP. Just because, remember, we're assuming that ZP doesn't move things very much. And so the class of alpha 1 and beta 1 in the homology is fixed. So we have alpha 1 in the homology of the exterior of F, fixed set, and beta 1 in the homology of the interior of F, fixed by ZP. And the direct sum of these two groups is just equal to the homology of F. And so we get alpha 1 and beta 1 in here. And their intersection is just given by the linking form over here, which is easily seen to be 1. So that gives one of the hyperbolic pairs. And the other one comes from this other genus over here. So this is, I originally thought that I could get this much more stronger property of F. But I can't see how to prove that now. OK, and we know something else, though, about the action, namely that ZP acts acts on, the image is non-trivial. So ZP acts on H1 of F non-trivially. And this comes from the fact that I added these loops here, and this homology of Z, if I pick epsilon small enough, is seen by the surface F. And so we had to have some non-trivial action here. And there just isn't any subgroup of the mapping class, any finite subgroup of the mapping class group satisfying these two properties. So that finishes the proof. So I think I'll stop here. Yes, I think people have tried to do that, and I've thought about trying to do this, but I mean the issue is what I think is how do you make sense of this quotient is sort of even worse than before, and what do you mean by its degree being divisible by p? You'd like to take the inverse image of a point in here and pull it back to here and say, well, ZP acts on acts on.
Degree one will work.
Yeah. Oh, yes. The degree one is no problem. Yeah. Degree p is yes. So I mean, if you could pull back a point and like the inverse image were say had a bunch of components and they were permuted, then you'd be done. But maybe you pull back a point and the inverse image is connected, and then I'm not really sure what to do.
Any more questions?
So you were building these loops. Is it, did you have to use the two-dimensional version of the theorem there? How do you know that they don't somehow form as a surface?
It's nothing specific about dimensions, but there's a lot of point set topology. I mean, I don't really know what the orbit of the loops looks like. But I mean, the only thing I can prove basically is that you look at the intersection of the orbit of this guy and the orbit of the loops, and you have some just the set of components of that, and ZP is acting non-trivially here, and then you use Meyer-Via-Torres to get that. But any sort of more geometric control, I don't really know what's going on.